Hi, everybody. This is Carmen LaSalle, and welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio and part two of our broadcast of a program sponsored by Media Alliance that took place on October 12, 2005 at 111 Minna Street in San Francisco. This program was dedicated to the study of the San Francisco Wireless Initiative. This initiative is what came out of an idea by Supervisor Tom Almiano that since the city had to replace its aging sewer system, when the streets were dug up, we could lay down permanent fiber optic cables beneath and make a wireless internet blanket beneath the whole city, dramatically improving high-speed communication access for everyone and making it much lower cost. The first part of this program featured the keynote speaker, Dr. Lawrence Lessig, a communications law professor at Stanford University. In this second part, we will hear from a panel of experts on digital availability. The panel was composed of Dr. Lessig, Dwayne Hendricks, Anna Montez, and Amy Tseng. Dwayne Hendricks is the CEO of the Danden Group Incorporated of Fremont. The Danden Group is dedicated to the belief that wideband wireless technology is the best prospect for connecting the world. The group is working to provide high-level access to the internet so its potential can be fully realized. Ana Montez is the Director of Technology and Consumer Education at the Latino Issues Forum, a public policy and advocacy institute dedicated to improving the lives of Latinos by producing high-quality research, conducting community education forums, building coalitions, serving as a resource to media and hard-hitting advocacy. Amy Tseng is the Managing Director of the Innovative Funders Network, an organization seeking to strengthen nonprofits and improve the lives of communities worldwide through the innovative use of information and communication technology. Jeff Perlstein, Executive Director of Media Alliance, will introduce the panel.
All right, so the three panels, I'll list their names, Dwayne Hendricks, Amy Tseng, and Anna Montez. We're gonna have Dwayne Hendricks go first. It's actually gonna go Dwayne, Anna, Amy. And so I'll give you the bio for Dwayne. He's the CEO of the Danden Group Incorporated, based in Fremont. They offer a comprehensive range of products and services for wireless communications via the internet. He's also been an active member of the Federal Communications Commission's Technological Advisory Council for the past 7 years. He was the co-principal investigator in the National Science Foundation's Wireless Field Test for Education project. The project successfully conducted remote educational institutions to the internet, from rural primary schools in Colorado to a university in Mongolia. He was a CEO and co-founder of Tetherless Access Limited, one of the first companies to develop and deploy unlicensed wireless metropolitan area data networks using the TCP/IP protocols. I always apologize when I toss out acronyms and don't take the time to explain them, but I'm gonna move on. He has participated in the installation of those networks in many parts of the world, including Kenya, Tonga, Mexico, Canada, and Mongolia. He's currently a member of the board of FirstMile.us, please check them out online, a great nonprofit advocacy group for big broadband for everyone, everywhere. Dwayne.
Thank you for showing up. So let me roll into my shtick here. I want to do a history thing too, like Larry did. Mine's wireless history. 1901, Marconi sent the first signal across the Atlantic. Okay. 1903, Marconi started making money sending signals across the Atlantic. 2 year uptick. Okay. The spectrum that nature provided was treated as an open commons until 1912. The Titanic disaster. From that point on, things changed, and we moved into a property model for spectrum. We've been that way ever since. Now, when there was a commons, if you could afford to buy the radio equipment, you could go and become a broadcaster, okay? As we moved into the property model, that changed, in that access was limited to the spectrum. Rights management, okay? So, that changed moving up to 1985 when the FCC enacted the unlicensed rules, Okay, so the spectrum, at least a small part of it, moved into a commons regimen. Okay, so if you could afford the equipment now, you could again broadcast like you could pre-Titanic. All right, and so it's taken 20 years from 85 to today, okay, this is the 20th anniversary, for this Wi-Fi phenomenon to happen, where basically you put down your money and you now all become broadcasters. This is a significant change, okay? It's taken 100 years to happen, okay? But there's no stopping it now. Now, 2 years ago, if I had stood up in front of this group and said that all the major cities in the United States would be soon be covered with a wireless cloud, you would have laughed me out the room, okay? It wouldn't have been deemed credible. Well, here we are today, and we're talking about it. In fact, it's happened in a lot of cities that don't get a lot of press. You know, there's a lot more going on than San Francisco and Philadelphia. The significant thing that's changed this year, which has not really hit any of your radar screens, is that counties have gotten into this act. Counties in Michigan, New Mexico, Oregon, Washington, okay, are doing this. It's not about cities anymore. Imagine the cat herding involved to get, like in Michigan, Oakland County, there's 65 governmental entities inside the county. Imagine the amount of cat herding necessary to make that happen. There are some phenomenal things going on in the political arena with this stuff, and it's all because of wireless. Wireless is the wild card, the fly in the ointment, okay, that's making infrastructure, as Larry brought out, possible, okay? The difference now is that you own the infrastructure, customer and user owned infrastructure. We haven't had that before in the history of telecom, okay? But it's happening now. So let me talk about this county thing, in that I'm involved in a project in New Mexico, a county called Sandoval, which is the county between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. It's 3,700 square miles. 3,700 square miles, that's over twice the size of the state of Rhode Island, okay? My company's been hired to put a wireless cloud over Sandoval County. We've just started the deployment. We have to get the first pilot project up by the end of this year, okay? By the end of next year, we'll have the entire county covered, 3,700 square miles. So put that in perspective to San Francisco, which is 50 square miles, okay? The technology exists to do this, I assure you, and the county government's mandate to us is we want a wireless network that outperforms cable and telco. We want Star Trek today. So, with that mandate and support, we are going to be delivering wirelessly to every citizen in the county 100 megabits symmetric. That's right, 100 megabits symmetric. Now, this may sound like science fiction, and 2 years from now, think about it. I mean, here we are, counties are involved. Where are we going to be 2 years from now? It boggles the imagination. So, hey, San Francisco, catch up, you know? I mean, Google, 300 kilobits free. Well, hey, why not do 100 megabits, okay? If you look at what's going on in the rest of the world, they're moving towards big broadband, okay? Big broadband. All right, Larry, you know, if you do the math here, we're 16th now rather than 13th and going down fast, all right? So we have no national broadband policy, and so we have no context for innovation to occur. But the thing is now, you're the innovators. You're the broadcasters, okay? You have the freedom to build the infrastructure that you want and desire. Go do magic.
Thank you, Dwayne. So we're gonna have a chance, as I said, to ask some questions and continue the
to stir it up a little bit, I want to bring up our second panelist. Okay, so now standing is Ana Montes. She is the Technology Policy Director at the Latino Issues Forum. It's a nonprofit public advocacy and policy institute based in San Francisco with offices in Fresno and Ontario, California. That's down south. LIF is dedicated to advancing new and innovative public policy solutions for a better, more equitable, and prosperous society. During Ana's tenure, Latino Issues Forum has played a vital role in representing the Latino community at the California Public Utilities Commission on issues of technology and telecommunication. LIF has distinguished itself as one of the few community-based organizations actively working to protect, educate, and mobilize California's limited English-speaking community members, not just Spanish-speaking community members, more broadly as well, in the area of consumer protections. Their Signature Learning Project, Rural Technology Information Project, and Communities for Telecom Rights Project are powerful models that show that certain segments of the population continue to have different obstacles to prevent them from being able to fully participate in this new technology era. Through these projects, LIF has also helped to demonstrate that viable solutions to address the digital divide in these underserved communities are possible. Please give her a warm welcome.
I got an email today that a rumor that SBC is changing its name to AT&T Global. how many of you, I want to show a raise of hands, and I'm going to ask for true or false. How many of you believe that the gap is closing when it comes to digital divide? True? Well, I can throw out half my speech. In 1996, I first began to work on trying to bring access to the internet to underserved communities by working with America Online. In 1996, we developed a national project to bring to create content in communities throughout the United States. The project failed in one way, but yet was very successful in another way. AOL also felt that there wasn't a market for Latinos, so they were not very cooperative with us. The project was successful in the sense that we learned a lot about what are the needs of underserved communities. We were able to create a national project where we distributed equipment and did training with many organizations throughout the United States that are successfully using the internet now to develop content and provide access to information to underserved communities. The reason why I bring this up is because that's one of the things that's more important than anything else. It's a fact that many Latinos still don't have access to the internet or equipment or training. And it's important to continue working from that perspective because it also impacts low-income communities. And it's important to realize as we develop a wireless plan that we also have to make sure that it's implemented in a way that works and in a way that brings everybody online and using the technology in a way that's most effective for their communities. So although many more users are becoming part of the information technology revolution, the divide remains particularly evident among Latino and other racial ethnic groups. Extremely important in a state where one-third of the population is Latino, and another portion, even greater portion of the population are immigrants living in California that have issues such as language, low educational attainment, and low income. In San Francisco, we have a high immigrant population, and so we have to be very, very conscious of how we create a wireless program that does indeed provide access to all. In the United States, only 14% of Latinos are employed in managerial and professional positions. So it's a myth that most people have access to the internet. If they don't have it at home, they'll have access to it at the workplace or the equipment to access the internet. Deployment and use of broadband continues to increase across the country, but the technology has some ways to go in order to reach underserved communities. Research has demonstrated that low-income neighborhoods have fallen behind without both the connectivity and the tools to access broadband internet services. For example, many of our students in the San Francisco public schools are falling behind in math and literacy and math and literacy scores. A plethora of resources are available to those students via the internet to tutor them and help them catch up and possibly achieve a goal of a college education. Most of the internet educational resources, however, are only available via broadband service. So many students in low-income neighborhoods don't even have dial-up access, so these services are not available to them. One of the things that we did is we created a couple of model projects. And one of those model projects is a project that we created here in San Francisco called the Signature Learning Project. The Signature Learning Project was a project that we created to show how you bring access to low-income communities. So we developed a project in the Outer Mission and worked with Bayview Hunters Point and Mission families. We set a target of working with 250 families, and that equaled to about 500 students in that school. What we did is we provided them with internet access, a computer, and training for the parents and teachers. Now, there's also another myth out there that for the Latino community, one of the reasons why they don't embrace technology is because there's a cultural issue. Well, that's not true. It's not a cultural issue. It's an income issue. What we found out when we worked with parents and teachers was that every single parent felt that access to technology was important. Out of our goal of reaching 250 families, we reached 230. 230 parents came to a training for a 12-hour training, 3 hours a week, in order to learn how to use technology. I mean, the reason why we did this is because we know that in order for children to be supported, you have to have family involvement. So we felt that it was important to bring access to the parents in order for them to support their kids. And the biggest problem that we found with the families, and we didn't just have moms going, we had mom, we had dad, we had brothers, we had sisters, we had aunts and uncles, and we even had three generations of family members attending. We also had babysitters coming. A lot of the kids stayed with babysitters, and they came so that, because at the end of the training, these families took home a computer and had internet access. And so we taught these people how to not only use the computers and the internet, but also how to take care of their equipment. And the biggest problem that we found was when one parent told us, "My dinner's late every night because my wife is on the internet doing comparative shopping." And that was one of the biggest problems we found. What we also found out is that reading comprehension went up. We also found that people got jobs based on the training that they received through the training that we gave to the parents. This was only 12-hour training. Because what we did is we developed curriculum that was useful to the families. We taught them how to do online banking. Many of them didn't have bank accounts, but we introduced them to banking and let them know that they could have a banking account. Because a lot of people within the Latino community in particular, in the poor community, don't even have access to bank accounts. So we developed curriculum that got them to do online banking and in turn worked out a relationship with banks, because this is also all about partnerships, to help them get free ATM cards and checking accounts. So what we did is we developed useful curriculum that brought value to the lives, even though they all participated because they knew it impacted their kids. We also found out that people did internet searches to find jobs and found jobs. And the average age of the people that participated was 36. And so we found a lot of success in that program. We also took what we learned and worked in a rural community. We worked in Watsonville, California, and worked with farm workers. And again, we had a lot of generations of families attending. I mean, huge success of parent involvement in the project. But we also provide computer access, and we provided computers and training in language. Another part of the project was the development of content. And so we created a website, which the families use to this day. Because of the partnership, the project has spun off in Watsonville, California, and is now a 501c3. So because we developed a sustainable part into the project, which was creating partnerships with schools, communities, and business. And it worked, and it was very useful. So these are some of the models. We also have another project here in the Bay Area called the Online Civic Engagement Project. Because the other thing about internet access is that not only do underserved communities not have access, community-based organizations that provide services to these communities also face a digital divide. So when we look at the whole wiring communities and providing access, we also need to look at those groups that provide services. We found out that many community-based organizations in the Bay Area located in a city that is supposed to have such high connectivity because of the fact that we're so close to Silicon Valley, share computers, have maybe one or two access lines in an office, and can't effectively use the internet. So Wi-Fi networks will really help them to do business and to make their jobs more efficient. However, they also don't have airport cards in their computers. I work in an office with 15 computers. We only have one computer that has an airport card in it. So we do have to address the fact that there is a problem with equipment. We also have a lot of CBOs that in a survey that we did reported that they needed 70% of these groups needed training. Finally, what I wanted to share with you was two things. One is that when you look at the percentages of broadband access, the percentages are actually a lot lower than they're reported. And because you also have to break it down by income. When you look at it by income, what you'll find that in California, only 8% of families with less than $15,000 have broadband access. Families with $15,000 to $30,000, only 11% have access. Families that earn between $30,000 and $50,000 have about 18% of them have access to broadband in their homes. So there's still a long ways to go. And then the figures are even lower when you're looking at broadband access by ethnicity and income. So what we've learned is that technology for some is still expensive. So we can't just develop a model that provides wireless access if you don't have the proper equipment. The other thing, which we have to be very conscious, is when we're addressing putting together a budget to provide access, we also have to look at it, how do you want to access? Frankly, I don't want to work off a Palm Pilot or a small device, because what I do is when I put things on my palm, I go to my computer to print it out and look at it. I don't want to write reports on a small piece of equipment that I can't really look at and I can't work with effectively. So we also have to be careful on how we what kind of equipment that we're going to be getting out there for people to use. I wouldn't want my daughter trying to do her homework on a Palm Pilot. The other thing is language is important. How you learn and how you comprehend is based on language. So that's also an important need for these communities. The other thing is training has to be useful and relevant. Otherwise, the value will not be seen. Public and private partnerships, school, community, business partnerships work, because that's what we need. I have a couple of policy recommendations, which I'll make later, but those are some of the things that I wanted to share with you.
Thank you, Anna.
Okay, our final panelist, I almost feel like I'm in a, yeah, I felt like a, almost a, no, I wasn't gonna say that, a dating game. Our final panelist, bachelor number four. Amy Tsung is currently the managing director of the Innovation Funders Network and the senior policy advisor at the Community Technology Foundation of California. She previously worked at the Ford Foundation on issues of information and communications policy. She's consulted on technology policy and strategy for a number of public interest and community networking groups, including Consumers Union, NYC Wireless, and LINCOS, which stands for Little Intelligent Communities. So please welcome Emmy.
First, I'll tell you a little bit about who I am. As Jeff stated, I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at the Community Technology Foundation of California, and I want to acknowledge that a number of our grantees and fellows are in the audience, so I'm really happy to see you and acknowledge all the great work that you do. I'm also the community representative in the review process for the San Francisco Tech Connect project's recent request for information and comments. So as the community representative, I'm basically there to represent the viewpoints of you all, the residents of San Francisco. So the Community Technology Foundation of California is a statewide public foundation dedicated to increasing access and the use of information and communications technology in underserved communities. The communities that we work with and the organizations that we work with are at-risk youth, low-income communities, especially communities of color, disabled community, immigrants, limited or non-English-speaking communities. We believe fundamentally that these technologies can empower people to engage politically, address social and economic issues, better their communities, and further goals for social justice. We've worked with more than 350 organizations through our grants program, our leadership training, and policy advocacy. And again, a number of you are here. I think we've funded or have fellows representing about 70 nonprofit organizations in San Francisco. So I'm here to somewhat tell you the positions that we're bringing forth to this process, and also invite your input and feedback into the process. So the Community Technology Foundation supports the efforts of community and municipalities to provide low-cost, ubiquitous internet access to underserved communities. We're very excited to work with the City of San Francisco in their efforts to bring affordable broadband to all city residents. However, as been mentioned several times tonight, that internet access is only one aspect of the quote-unquote digital divide. As our society grows increasingly dependent on the availability of internet applications and content, these communities need access to affordable hardware and software, training and education to develop the technology skills to best utilize the internet for their own purposes, and relevant content. And I would like to emphasize content created by the communities themselves. Residents who lack this access are increasingly placed at a disadvantage in seeking healthcare, education, housing, and employment, and the ability to engage in civically and in political affairs. So therefore, the recommendations that we're bringing forth, the main recommendation is that the TechConnect project should focus on the needs of San Francisco's underserved communities first. Internet access should be available to residents of underserved communities for free or at an affordable price point. The network should be open and promote choice and competition, even in, maybe especially in, underserved communities. The project should include programs that address issues of hardware access, technology literacy, language barriers, accessibility for individuals with disabilities, and lack of relevant content and programs. One interesting statistic that you might have heard of is that in a recent Pew study, over 75% of the web content is created by white, college-educated, upper-income people. Therefore, at CTFC, we really emphasize the need for training programs and fund a number of training programs for content creation so that this new media really reflects diversity and viewpoints and experiences of all communities. And this is especially important in the era of consolidated commercial media, where when these communities are portrayed, they're usually portrayed negatively. We recommend that the city use an inclusive planning process to develop these programs, especially again around the education and content and literacy. The process should provide ongoing, meaningful opportunities for community input, especially from underserved communities, since these communities know best what services, applications, and content will address their needs. Lastly, the project or the program should leverage San Francisco's extensive network of nonprofits and community-based organizations that use and promote technology to achieve their social missions. And, a lot is made of about the proximity to Silicon Valley. Well, really, San Francisco is one of the epicenters of the nonprofit technology movement, and really the city has a real opportunity to leverage all the resources that you all bring. So in summary, the foundation applauds the city's efforts to build a broadband wireless network throughout San Francisco, and that the city needs to address the lagging technology adoption and learning curve issues to truly address this digital divide and attain true universal access. Thank you.
Here is Jeff Perlstein again.
So Media Alliance is a member-supported organization. We also have other ways that we get support through running classes and workshops. We have some grant support, but it's largely from members, people who care about these issues. And so if you care about these issues and you want to see this dialogue continue and campaigns around issues like these move forward, please consider becoming a member. There's a bunch of information at the door, and there's various levels of membership too. There's lots of different ways you can participate. And there's also lots of campaigns that we have working on. We'll talk a little bit about some ways to stay involved at the end. I also want to quickly see, the word is that we invited one of the supervisors who's been really strong in this issue here. And I think he's in the back, but I can't see. Is he back there? Yeah. Okay, so we want to give a quick couple minutes. We want to give a shout out to Ross Mercurimi for supporting all this work, for pushing issues around municipalization. I don't know, do you want to take a couple minutes or are you good? You want to? Okay, why don't you come up and say like a quick couple minutes of greetings, and then we're gonna roll to our panel. I'm gonna try to move this. I wanna be careful of the laptop and stuff, but. So Ross, thank you. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Hi, yeah. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good evening. I'm Ross Mercurimi. I'm supervisor in District 5. For those of you who know me or not know me, I'll share with you a very simple philosophy that may very well be shared by many of you. And that is, I believe that our airwaves are of public domain and they should be owned by the public, quite frankly. And that the fact is, San Francisco should be working very, very hard to be municipalizing all our utilities. And to have a discussion about free Wi-Fi broadband is a very relevant discussion that absolutely that we would support. But if our city hall is not talking about, and if we're not leading the charge about municipalizing what our telecom or through our cable industry or what we're able to provide for people, then there will always be a digital divide. I can tell you, I serve a community, the second largest black population in San Francisco. There are technology centers sprouting up everywhere. Federal and state grants are affording communities now and underserved communities to allow technology service to sprout up. But a lot of these technology centers are not well used. In fact, a lot of them are very empty. So there's sort of the programmatic absence where people are not being pooled and not being seduced or intrigued or even educated to try to come in to use these technology centers. What about the very vote that we had recently? We lost 6-5 in trying to shape the Comcast agreement with San Francisco. The fact that a forward-thinking city like San Francisco, and I tried to lead the charge with some strong colleagues of mine about amending the Comcast agreement, and we lost. We lost on amendments on trying to increase the labor protections. We lost in the agreement with trying to give San Francisco greater independence from corporations so that we can go ahead and chart our own sort of future of what it will like with cable, with broadband, et cetera. And the fact we lost on in a 6-5 vote is very telling. And it's telling about potentially what will San Francisco do to brace itself for the technological obsolescence of as these things turn, and yet San Francisco is continuously dependent on a corporation. So as far as I'm concerned, the discussion is about what can we do to municipalize as well and making sure that everybody across the board, as far as I'm concerned, for free, should be able to benefit in the way that they're not. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. And thank you for your leadership, a key ally in the Comcast fight who's really been pushing for public power and municipalizing municipal utilities on a lot of levels. It's also important to recognize that this initiative, while this current incarnation is coming from the mayor's office, that it will have to pass through the supervisors. So there is, you know, lots of political questions around how we make sure that we build the political will. We're working with our allies there, and we're educating those who aren't currently our allies on the Board of Supervisors. So there's plenty of really brilliant questions, which are not a surprise, but the challenge is how to get them. There are some common themes, so I'm going to do my best to try to hit them. I apologize in advance if I don't get your question or theme. Like I said, one of our next steps is to figure out some follow-up forums and how to keep this conversation going, how to raise these not just in forums like these, but in the press to the broader public. So the first question that I wanted to put out there, which seems like it's coming up, is what does it mean if one company, whether it's Google or Earthlink or Tropos, is quote-unquote running the network or building the network. What are the implications for openness, for competition, for other ISPs? And is this the same? Is there one boilerplate, or can it look different in different places as far as openness to other providers? Is there anyone who wants to take that one or can? Yeah?
So I don't think the relevant question is whether it's one company or two companies. It's what those companies commit to, what principles they commit to. So if a company commits to the principles that I was describing as network neutrality principles, then I don't think there's as much to worry about in the fact that there's one company playing the game. What we've seen historically is that network owners have believed that they have the right not to be neutral, but to control and to exploit the network in the way that makes the most money for them. And it's not surprising what that network looks like. It serves high-income neighborhoods well at relatively high prices and doesn't think much about how it's going to encourage all sorts of innovation that might be against that network. That makes sense for them. What policymakers have got to recognize is what makes sense for Comcast doesn't make sense for the nation, right? And we've learned this again and again as we've opened up networks and realized the benefit of that. And we have this extraordinary opportunity, largely because of, as Dwayne was saying, the opportunity given to us by wireless. An experiment that really came out of the Reagan administration, right? Remember, 20 years ago, it was the Reagan administration. He was a Reagan administration worker, right? He pushed this experiment in a way that now blows up the central claim of the network owners, that we've got to own it if we're going to build it. And we should take advantage of that and encourage the widest range of neutral development we can.
So, and I'll just piggyback on that and say that there are a range of ways that this is being deployed and rolled out in different cities across the U.S., everything from actually the municipality owning the actual network, owning the fiber, owning the backbone, or owning the actual devices, and companies coming in and operating them, to all across the map. And I'll actually point folks to a great resource for seeing all these different, the spectrum of deployment, which is a website. If you're not familiar, please check it out. It's muniwireless.com. That's M-U-N-I wireless.com, which really gives a real sense of how broadly all these things are happening out there. So that's one key question for sure that's coming up several times. Another question is this, this dynamic of one company or even the city coming in and laying over a model that goes across the whole city, because it's important to recognize there are community internet projects that are currently existing that actually were pioneering, that have been pushing the envelope, and there's a question about what this will do to those networks, and should there be a more decentralized sort of approach that really supports and builds off of, for example, and fosters the growth of community-based networks and can pop up perhaps in an overlapping way or some coordinated fashion. So, Dwayne, do you want to chime in on that? Yeah.
My company is a commercial wireless ISP here in the Bay Area. There are a total of 50 wireless ISPs in the Bay Area. So we are all using that Spectrum Commons to deliver services. A lot of our the ISPs go for business customers. I know that's what we do. And we're able to deliver quality of service and all the other things you need to do to service business customers. We're all sharing that spectrum, and it just seems to work in that the equipment gets better and better and better, in that we're into 6-month product cycles, so we're seeing new products every 6 months. So we have not seen the tragedy of the commons mime manifest itself, okay? I mean, we've been talking about it, looking for it, which is not to say there isn't isolated issues of interference and stuff, but it seems that we can keep dumping more and more devices into this. It's sort of a Darwinian kind of soup, okay, a survival of the fittest. And so what you do as a consumer is that you buy a device, and if it doesn't work, you throw it away and get the other one, because the disposable cost is quite low, and you can sort of experiment, okay? And there are, like, I think at least 400 vendors doing both standards-based and non-standards-based wireless devices. So there's a tremendous, basically think about that. Even in the face of standards, you're getting companies are saying, look, I'll roll the dice. I'll go out and raise money on the market and come out with this product which I think is better, which I think you'll buy, okay, so I can make money and you can do what you want to do. So this is the trick here in that you can do community. It's like if the city screws up this wireless cloud, the citizens can do it. You know, you can, you know. You can do neighborhood area networks. This is the beauty of this innovative thing right now, this wireless thing, that wasn't possible before. So the power is really with you if you look at it. So don't sit back and say, whatever the city does, you can do better. You can. It's like, just make it happen. Barn building, remember that? You know, community.
So thanks. And in that conversation, I want to mention just a few of the kind of pioneering projects that are existing here in San Francisco. So there's SF LAN, which is a free wireless network, Bay Area Wireless Research Network. Is that right? Did I get it right? Yeah, there's several acronyms. And then there's a bunch of community networks and people who are also just making their networks available to their neighbors. There's also some really amazing projects that are happening around the state and nationally that are community-driven projects. So there's the, I'm going to get the name wrong, is it Digital Tribal Village? Yes, in Southern California. That's really worth checking out online. You can find information about that at muniwireless.com also. There's a couple issues there I wanted to flag that came up, and I'm not sure we're going to get them all tonight. So one was a question of obsolescence, technological obsolescence, and that's been raised before in kind of challenging the wireless initiative is, well, shouldn't we wait till we see what happens and shakes out a little bit more? Because there's this thing called WiMAX, which is like super broadband, and these little dinky transmitters are going to be, we're going to need to throw them out in a year or two. Related to that question is the ecological and environmental impacts of moving through some of this technology, as well as discarding computers. And related to that is also a question around, that's been raised by some communities around the impact of radiation in our communities, whether that's from cell phone towers or from wireless networks and this sort of thing. So these are all questions that we're keeping an eye on and want to surface a bit as fodder for ongoing pieces. The last piece I wanted to use to spring off of that and hopefully segue over to Amy and Anna a bit on this and others is not just the community-driven nature of the networks, but the community-driven potential for training. We already see existing training centers, which have been mentioned, around computers and attempting to bridge the digital divide and doing a significant job at that. Here in the Bay Area, there's actually, I believe, 130 community technology centers, many of them based in low-income communities or historically marginalized communities, whether that's in Bayview Hunters Point, whether that's in the Filipino community here in south of Market. So these centers have developed really sophisticated technological training and analysis, but also have very significant and deep relationships with their communities. So it's a question, if we're talking about training and a citywide initiative, does it make sense to herd everyone into Bill Graham Civic Auditorium to come there and get trained by a couple people? Or does it make sense to build on the kind of local, indigenous, if you will, knowledge, strength, and expertise in local communities that can provide culturally appropriate and relevant training, content, production, all this sort of stuff? So maybe I can hand down, I see Anna and both Amy nodding their heads if they want to riff on that.
Well, I certainly believe that there's a lot of other things that we need to be concerned about, but what I'll address is, do we wait? No. If we wait, we are going to continue creating an even wider gap because, I mean, this is all about information, and it's about having access to information that affects our lives on a daily basis. So I think that especially in some of these communities, I mean, there isn't access. There isn't technology centers in some of these hard-to-serve communities. And I think Amy mentioned before, we need to target those communities because in our projects, we had to build community technology centers in those communities. There weren't any. And a lot of the centers that are out there that are working with community, which are excellent centers and, you know, should be prioritized as well, many of them are set up to work with youth. And so a lot of adults get left out. So I think that it's imperative that we immediately identify communities that don't have community technology centers and make sure that the community technology centers are built and work with all of those communities that have experience and trust of the communities, and those that are in existence are included in this statement, to work with communities, because if you have an empty center, then that speaks to another problem that might also be the reason for an empty center. Maybe that center doesn't know how to do proper outreach. Maybe that center doesn't have enough money to be able to do the training that they need to do to be open during the hours that they need to be open. And so there's a real need to do this and to continue investing in these communities, because if they're located in the communities they serve, they know what the local issues are. They know what the local needs are. They know what the languages that are spoken are. They know what the cultural issues are. And so together and working with those communities, they're going to develop that relevant training. And they're going to be able to develop relevant content and increase access to the internet. So if we wait, what we do is we really end up harming our communities.
I'd just like to touch on a couple points that that were brought up. Let's see, in terms of, I totally agree with Anna, we can't wait. I mean, the divide is growing, that people really need this access to this new media and need to be able to participate in not only accessing the information too, but creating this medium. Another point that Dwayne brought up about how there are a number of commercial wireless ISPs out there, and that many of them address the needs of business communities, that really points to why there does need to be some programs, whether it's a municipal citywide program or ongoing ongoing community programs to address this. So it's like, you know, we welcome all sorts of approaches, and in fact we fund lots of, so even while we're participating very closely with the city on their project, we are also funding organizations such as One Economy to provide broadband access through power line, through wireless. So, you know, basically, you know, the technologies are ever evolving, so there needs to be a lot of experimentation. I don't only mean technological experimentation, but about what models work, what models really address these people's needs. Again, to bring up the point on leveraging the infrastructure that's here. For example, I think in San Francisco, there are 40 widely spoken or primarily spoken languages. So the idea of not leveraging the groups that already do the training and provide content is, you know, it's silly. So, anyways.
Thank you. So a couple more questions, and then we're going to go to closing comments, and we're going to wrap it up and mix it up. Okay. So the next question that I had was specifically related to what to do. I think I'm going to wait for just a second on what to do, but we want to leave some time for that and definitely get there. And the question that I wanted to lob at you all is not right here. So let's go to what to do, because that's the most important thing we want to make sure we cover. One thing that I want to mention related to this, and this will maybe be a segue into people giving their own pieces, is that there's actually a lot of pushback on this, if people haven't already gotten that in the subtext of people's presentations. The big telcos, certainly like AT&T, SBC, Comcast, Verizon, don't want to, what was the phrase that they used? They don't want the blood sucked out of their veins. They spend all this money on building this stuff. And so there's just tremendous pushback, as we saw in Pennsylvania, we've seen in plenty of other states. We have no illusion that there's not going to be pushback here in San Francisco or in California. And so there's already been pushback, too, at the federal level. So I just want to mention these kind of several layers of activity and ways to get involved and keep an eye on what's happening here. When in Texas, public interest advocates beat back, there were 203 lobbyists deployed to the Texas State House. 203 lobbyists deployed to the Texas State House by SBC, who's based in San Antonio, to try to ban municipal broadband wireless projects in Texas. And by a massive, tremendous, powerful organizing effort, because it resonates with the public that municipalities should have the very right to do this for their citizenry, their residents, they were able to beat this back in some really smart organizing. So that points to the way that we can beat them back. What happened, though, is that there's a congressional rep in Texas who then said, well, screw you, I'm going to take it to the federal level and I'm going to preempt you at the top. So there's several bills in Congress right now around doing away with and forcing states and municipalities not to be able to offer this at all. So there's some bills, it's called the Sessions Bill, Pete Sessions is his name,
That's one to oppose. And McCain-Lautenberg have put out a pro-municipal broadband bill that's important to support. So there's links to those on the Media Alliance website. I know there's resources on the Muni Wireless website as well, and a number of others. So that's the national layer. If they succeed in that, then it's going to trump all these other layers, most likely. So we need to definitely keep our eye on that prize. There's also state-level initiatives that you've seen of going to the state houses. So we're keeping an eye on Sacramento, and we're working with partners around the state to really try to organize to make sure that we're educating folks there and also able to mobilize quickly. On the proactive side around California, I want to mention an upcoming event. It's the first ever California Wireless Summit that Media Alliance is co-convening with Common Assets Defense Fund and Aspiration Tech. It's supported by the Community Technology Foundation. And the idea is to bring community-based organizations and community-based practitioners and community technology centers together to develop strategy and policy, state level and also local, because it's great that this is happening in San Francisco. It's great that there's a deployment that did happen in Lompoc and a few other places, but this should be happening in cities and towns all around the state. So we want to build a network to share information, deploy these things, and also be ready for the state pushback. That's at the state level. And then, what's that? When? Oh, that summit, thank you, is the end of this month. It's October 28th and 29th. It's in San Diego in Southern California, but there's going to be caravans going there. There's also some stipends for folks who are involved with community-based organizations. You can speak with Sydney Levy, our program director, also Carrie Gray. I'm not sure she's in the room right now, waving her hand in the back with Common Assets as well. Then bringing it to the local, there's a number of things I want to have folks suggest what to do in San Francisco, and then maybe I'll make some suggestions too. But before we go to San Francisco, I just want to mention, get a show of hands, there's any folks who either live or work in places other than San Francisco in the Bay Area? Yeah. Are there municipal wireless networks where you are? No. Okay. So we need to get on the ball, and part of what we're doing is trying to figure out who we should be having conversations with in the other places in the Bay Area, because Media Alliance is not just an SF organization. It's actually a statewide organization based here in Northern California. So we want to share this models, this information, and leverage our networks to really make sure this is happening all around the Bay, statewide, and across the country. So if you're from other places, especially Oakland, but other places too, please be in touch with us after this event. We definitely want to catch up with you and figure out some strategies to move that conversation forward. I'm going to pause and maybe send it down the line for folks and kind of closing comments and suggestions on how to be active, whether more broadly or specifically here in San Francisco, and then I'm going to take the privilege of some closing comments in SF.
Okay, so I have two suggestions about how to become more active. The first is to become like Dwayne. Now, so Dwayne described a very boring part of his life, like building commercial networks, and you're sitting there thinking, what the hell is this? But Dwayne's history is a kind of guerrilla warfare regulator. Right, so he started inside the FCC, and he saw government was going to go nowhere with it. As soon as they had great ideas, the lobbyists came in and shut it down. And so then what he did is he went outside of the government, and he started actually building the networks to demonstrate that they would work. All the theorists said it could never be done. So he went to Tonga, he went to Native American tribes all across both the United States and in Canada, and began building these networks in places people said it couldn't be built. And that is the only strategy that works, that you can take Congress people out to places and show them, your telecom company says it's going to cost $150 a person to do it. We've done it at a fraction of the cost. And once you actually demonstrate it by building it, the arguments against it go away. So the first most important thing is to go out and actually get this done. Don't wait and push it. Let's get this done quickly before the telecoms figure out how to stop it. That's number one. Number two, this is the hardest, but I think in some sense the most important debate. Dwayne got this going with a tiny little bit of spectrum, the worst possible spectrum. The reason they left unlicensed the space that most 802.11 stuff lives is that that was the spectrum area that microwave ovens occupied, right? So they said, well, if it's microwave ovens there, there's no reason to try to allocate it to anybody. Just let anybody do what they want. Because it's microwave ovens, what that means is it's resonating right where water is, so that means radio waves can't go through tree leaves, or when it's raining, it screws things up. It's the worst possible spectrum yet. In the worst possible spectrum, we built the most amazing networks that Spectrum has seen. Now, this ought to lead people who are rational about policy to say, we need to open up more spectrum. we need to take spectrum and and make it more and more spectrum unlicensed, what Duane calls the commons. But that's precisely the opposite of what's happening in Washington right now. There's a huge chunk of spectrum. It's basically UHF spectrum, the spectrum that was used for UHF channels. How many people even know what UHF is anymore, right? I mean, how many people watch UHF television, right? Nobody. Oh, one. Okay, I'm sorry. You're going to lose. Now, the question is, when you lose, who wins? Because they're taking the spectrum and they're allocating it. Now, the way they're allocating is just what Duane describes. They're selling it off. They want to sell it off as property to the Verizons of the world, who will build shitty little cell phone networks that don't do anything compared to what these open commons networks will do, right? Now, instead of there being a vigorous debate in Washington about what proportion should we be selling, should we be selling 90% to the Verizons, or 80%, or 70%, or 60%, the debate is just how much can we sell so that we can raise a piddly tiny amount of money to fund the deficit, right? Now, if you take the economic value, both absolutely and egalitarian economic value, namely how quickly can we spread access across the world, and ask what would we do if we took half of that spectrum and set it free to unlicensed uses, it would be an extraordinary boon to everything we've been talking about tonight. Yet politicians don't even hear the question, because the debate has not been framed in these terms, and this is exactly what organizations like Media Alliance and other organizations need to be pushing. So two things. One, build it from the ground up in guerrilla warfare style like Duane, and start beating across the heads of the politicians the idea that property-defining spectrum is a mistake here. The only system that's produced wild growth and success is a commons model, and we ought to at least be experimenting with more of it, not just with the worst slices of spectrum that's out there.
Larry said it so well. The only thing I would add would be, he's right. I'm a gorilla, okay, and I take point. So this county project in New Mexico I described to you, 3,700 square miles, is not the only one of that size that's going on in the country right now. But that's an existence proof, you know, because here in San Francisco, which is only 50 square miles, you know, you can take Sandoval County and some of the other ones say, hey, look, these people are doing this, you know? So we should be able to do it here, 50 square miles, you know, a dirt road in comparison, okay? Come on. So once you know something's possible, it changes everything. So reach out. Talk to the other people. There's a lot of resources out there that can help you do your own guerrilla stuff, okay? Tremendous resources out there. Find them, talk to them, establish communities, do it.
Participate. Participate at whatever level that you're able to do. What I have found is that what gets the attention of legislators in Sacramento is 10 letters. 10 letters. I mean, that's amazing. The other thing I've learned is that if enough community people respond to issues, they'll listen, and sometimes you'll get what you want, and sometimes you won't, but participation is crucial. I've been involved in working on local legislation that had very few participants. I became an expert at the Public Utilities Commission by being the only person at a meeting. So your participation is really important. We had an effort with not a whole lot of people that forced the governor to give us back a California Teleconnect program. We had $175 million sitting in a pool of funds in the Treasury. Governor's office saw it and took it. We went back and we sent letters and we talked to legislators and we got the money restored. Things died down, the governor decided to kill the program. We got people involved again, saved the program. And now what we're doing is working on legislation to get them to pay back the money. So the thing is participate at any level that you possibly can. You know, go to meetings if you can. Send in a letter if you can, and get other people to sign that letter. So I think that's what's really going to be key here, because one is they're going to have to listen to large numbers of people. Two, There's a lot of people that need to be reelected. Three, we also represent not only constituents, but we represent a market. So I think it's really important to try to participate at whatever level that you possibly can.
Okay, well, you basically said it all. I just actually want to acknowledge how honored I am to be part of this panel, just to acknowledge the work, the legal theory, and the work that Larry and Yohai Bankler have done around Spectrum, and that and all the technology and regulatory work that Dwayne has done, and acknowledge, yes, this happened. The reason that all the spectrum wasn't sold off was because of these quote-unquote guerrilla networks or these community networks, NYC Wireless, the Bay Area. You had an enormous effect on policy. So I want to acknowledge that and all the community work that Anna and her group has done. Basically, I think it's really important in terms of countering the tide, especially with the resources that are behind the incumbent telecom providers, is to tell our stories of how this access, how these opportunities really benefit communities all across the country. I mean, that's our opportunity, and that's our real hope. Organizations such as Consumers Union on their Hear Us Now website are gathering community stories. So is Free Press at the national level. That's a lot of the reason why we're sponsoring this Community Wireless Summit within California, because we need to strategize right now. And then in terms of locally, I'm happy to receive input on the Tech Connect and what you think should be the public interest criteria. My email address is emy@zerodivide.org.
So let's have a hand for our panelists.
I'm going to wrap up real quickly. I want to make sure you stick around to mix it up. And also stay for the DJ, but I'll have some quick last suggestions on ways to get involved, because I think people are all here because they're interested in the issue and are all here probably looking for something to do as a next step. The challenge is that there actually has not been a public process laid out moving forward for this initiative in San Francisco, and that's one of the concerns that we've raised in our comments. There was a very brief public comment window, which was mostly an industry comment window, because there was very little resources put into letting the public know about this opportunity. It closed on September 30th. Media Alliance was kind of scrambling at the last minute to try to get the word out, working with some other folks, and actually, thanks to some of you and others, in about a week, we were able to get 250 comments in, which is not a whole lot, but it was significant, and it actually was very robust commentary. Which actually dwarfed the commentary by industry and by other actors. So we think it will have an impact. But what we want to really figure out and articulate is a public process, whether or not the elected officials are setting one up. They should be listening to all of you. They should be listening to folks who aren't here tonight, for communities who have something at stake here. And so that's what we are working to endeavor to do. So a couple things we want to suggest and ask for your participation and support of. One is that the comment form is still on our website. That's www.media-alliance.org. The city is still taking these comments and registering them. So there's some basic points that are in there, but you can change it and edit it, use the ones you like and put in your own and send those off. We also get a copy of those, and we're delivering those by hand, not just to the mayor's office, but to the supervisors. We also want to make sure that if you're affiliated with a community-based organization or an activist organization, and you see fit to endorse the key principles that we have on our website, many of which have been articulated tonight. There's a whole host of them. We really need a bunch of organizations to say, yeah, we're behind this effort. We want the city to really consider these issues that have been raised, but may not be front and center in what Google, for example, is putting out there. So organizational endorsements, please visit the site. There's a link there that you can click on very easily. We're also convening a meeting with a number of community-based organizations, especially organizations in underserved communities, to develop a joint strategy, how specifically they can have some role in this conversation, how we can develop a joint mobilization effort to be walking City Hall, to be educating their constituents. So if you're affiliated with an organization like that and you'd like to be involved in that conversation, please contact us in person or through the website. Just some quickies too. Sydney, my colleague, is involved with that effort. Also on the website, and just in general, please keep an eye on the papers
and on the press around this. We're already seeing a major pushback from SBC and Comcast and their lackeys. Also lots of conservative columnists like Deborah Saunders, who you may know just last week. So this really like factually incorrect, ridiculous article where she was a very knee-jerk sort of silly response to a lot of stuff. We can't let those go unchallenged. So keep an eye out. We'll be alerting you if you're signed up to Media Alliance's email list to give you some templates and alerting you to that sort of stuff. And we'll also be alerting you to other forums like these and also ones that are more town hall type forums with our elected officials that we're seeking to convene. So that's a mouthful, but I guess the basic thing is stay tuned, check out our website, talk to folks here in the room. Let's keep the conversation going. We know that there's a lot of interest, there's a lot at stake, and we know that when we work together, that's when they have to listen to us. They don't always listen to us, but when we come together, that's when it's more likely they will, and we can build power in that way for this fight and others to follow. So just want to thank you and look forward to chopping it up with you and moving on to see this on through. Thanks to our panelists. Thanks to you. Stick around. Have some fun.
This is Carmen LaSalle, and thank you for listening to part two of the San Francisco Liberation Radio production of the Media Alliance Evening on the San Francisco Wireless Initiative. I hope that you have enjoyed the broadcast, and remember that you can find Media Alliance at www.media-alliance.org, San Francisco Liberation Radio, a 24/7 internet radio station with a variety of DJs and music, is to be found at www.liberationradio.net.